So where were we? Well, thank you all for coming. I'm really touched and very much honored that Massoum agreed to do this this event with me. I wanted to say that one of my first experiences as a graduate student, when I just started to be interested in Islamic art, and I started as a Central Asianist, a Timurid, and I said that with Babur I walked to India, is that my mentor then, Oleg Rabar, took me to the Fair and Sackler to work on some paintings and illustrated manuscripts that we were writing on together. And Massoum set us up in a room and brought all these amazing materials, and it was the first time that I could actually see so up close those amazing works of art and really, you know, be so in such a kind of intimate proximity to them. And after that, nothing looked beautiful anymore, or as beautiful as in the Freer and Sackler. So every time we would go to another collection, I'd say, it does not measure up, so you guys spoiled me for life. And I'm grateful for that. So just a little bit about the book. In Mughal Occidentalism, I unpack the layered and complex ways in which Mughal artists engaged with European art during the time of emperors Akbar and Jahangir, so from about 1556 to 1627. During the second half of the 1580s, Mughal artists repurposed Christian iconographic motifs, Renaissance elements, and painting techniques into their compositions with great output and enthusiasm. And I'm showing you one example, and please ignore all the, or in this case, ignore these kind of titles. They're very misleading. These are kind of titles that were added later when those works of art were accessioned into the museum. It doesn't mean that this is really what is represented here. But I want you to pay attention to the way in which the artists were working the surface, the landscape, the volume of the body, and also the subject matter. So, and just to set things in proportions a little bit, this is what we see in Mughal painting before the kind of interactions with the Europeans begin to have an impact. And this is what happens, or kind of a typical, if there is a typical, so a typical page of an illustration of a text that we see later. And you see that the kind of different perspectives and different approach to the page composition, etc. Previously, scholars have labeled Mughal Occidentalism, and I call Mughal Occidentalism these kind of images that are contain European techniques or iconographic materials, etc. So previously scholars have labeled Mughal Occidental paintings as copies or imitations drawn from the European original visual traditions. So in the book I challenge such a paradigm that casts these Mughal paintings as essential derivative of Renaissance art. And I try to move away from a binary views of artistic exchanges. So for example, most of what you see in the literature, in the academic literature about these paintings is these kind of comparisons trying to understand what kind of European image had impacted the Mughal painting and to what extent or to what level the Mughal artists were successful, so to speak, in copying the Renaissance image into their own work. And I try to look at it from a different point of view, not thinking about this as copies at all. Reading through the book brings forth many of the intricate relationships between the Mughal elites and the various European groups, expressed in illustrated manuscripts and paintings. My research questions evolve around the meaning of such images in their Mughal context and what bearings do they have on the political and intellectual life of the court and the upper echelons in the Mughal period. So trying to see this from a Mughal perspective and not thinking about it as something that is derived from a European source, so to speak. I try to answer some of these questions by thinking about the point of view of the Mughal artists and their patrons. In the book, I demonstrate how innovative visual changes were grounded in the new Mughal policy of Sulh-i-Kul, which it means universal conciliation or peace with all, and the formation of a cosmopolitan empire. The overarching reforms of Sulh-i-Kul allowed the coexistence of North India's multiple ethnicities and religions and fosters cultural interactions with various European communities. Hence, the reconfigurations of Renaissance motifs into Mughal painting were not homage to Christian Europe, but rather dynamic and original creations imbued with references to policy, law, and the pluralistic cultural identities of the Mughal elite. My analysis, however, avoids what John Dixon Hunt or Barry Flood critique as emphasizing a binary power structure between Europe and India, or kind of East and West negotiations. And a little bit, so in the book I talk about the encounters and what really was the nature of the encounters between those various groups and entities. And there's also a tendency to talk about Europe as one group and not thinking about the multiplicity of and the nature of the encounters, and also the Mughals as another kind of group, not thinking about the various levels of connections. And so that's something that I dedicate the beginning of the book into unfolding. Also something that is important, at least was important to me, was the fact that the Jesuits take a very large space in those kind of, at least in the academic art historical world, where they, everything about those kind of relationship is connected to when the Jesuits came, and then everything starts. And we have to also pay attention to the fact that the Jesuits were a very oiled, refined, propagandistic machine. And there's a reason why we're paying so much attention to them, because they left a lot of writings and a lot of texts and materials, and not necessarily reflecting the kind of relationships that were actually happening between the Mughals and the Jesuits. Also, a lot of attention has been given to the gifts that the Jesuits brought to the court, because these are special objects, and they're special not necessarily, or were special not necessarily to the Mughals, but to the Jesuits and to Christian Catholic Europe. So in this case, we're talking about the Polyglot Bible, for example. So in one of the missions that the Jesuits came to Akbar, to the court of Akbar, they brought a Polyglot Bible. If you've ever seen one, this particular one was printed in Antwerpen in 1569 to 72. These are seven volumes, and they're about this size. They're huge, big, big volumes. And they have, some of them have illustrations or printed engravings. And then the question is, what happened to this Bible? Where is it? It's not in India. I mean, you cannot lose such an object so quickly, right? It's a big, enormous thing. Probably there is some, scholars have suggested that Akbar returned it to the Jesuit mission. But they're not that they're not talking about. They're only talking about the fact that they brought this Polyglot Bible, and everybody were excited about it, and they ran and they wanted to copy everything from that book. Where is the book or those books? What happened to them? So we have to look at those kind of encounters and the sources that we have from that period with very critical eyes, especially when it comes to the Jesuits. And one of the things that art historians have been trying very hard to do is to talk about the impact of the Polyglot Bible on Mughal paintings. But I was trying to do that too. I was trying to look at the impact of the Polyglot Bible on Mughal painting, especially when I know it came to India in 1580. So what do we see from 1580, 1590, right? Nothing, really not much. The only thing that can be more directly linked to any kind of image that is related to any of the images in the Polyglot Bible is this kind of figure. And it has, in terms of the meaning of the polyglot figure, they're totally different. It's a completely reinterpretation and reconfiguration of this kind of ideas. So when you start looking at the materials, the images begin to tell you a different story than what you see with the kind of other writings that you hear. And so I decided that one of the exercises that I'm going to do, and I think about those chapters as case studies. So in each chapter, there is a concept or kind of a concept or a way to approach the relationship, the artistic relationship with Europe. And I use those, the images or the paintings that I'm studying as case studies. And so in the first chapter, I was trying to see what are the closest in terms of the visual connections between several European images and Mughal paintings and see where it goes, where it takes me. So one of those images is this beautiful nude male by a female artist named Rukaya Banu. And scholars have been suggesting that she has been copying this kind of figure of Adam that is kind of an extraction from a European engraving that has been painted. I think I have a better image. Right, so the question is whether should we think about this as Adam? Is this really Adam from Adam and Eve, right, after the fall of man? What kind of text is written here? There is Persian poetry all around the image. What kind of text is written here? What is it telling me in order to understand the image? And then I have to think, why would Rukaya Banu, in the early 17th century, would be attracted to something like that? And what does it mean in that kind of context? So I was spending a lot of time at looking very, very carefully at the details and really trying to understand what is it that the artist was changing, what does it mean, and how should I think about then reading the Persian poetry and butchering the translation, but then trying to understand what would be the context of that. So when we look at them carefully, right, the fall of man is a very harsh moment in the text, in the Bible, right? This is the time in which Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden. This is where trouble begin, right? This is where the difficulty of life on earth as we know it start for them. So there, it's a very intense moment in terms of that figure, right? And you can see that there is this kind of looking inward with the aching of the body, right, after a hard day of labor. And this is not what we see here. First of all, this image, you see that it's yellow, but it's yellow because the page is speckled with gold flakes. And it really radiates light. When you look at the image, at the original, it beams with light. It's an incredible, amazingly beautiful image. There is nothing harsh about it. There is a man that's sitting in a similar pose, but looking inward. And if we have to think about what kind of men we know in India that are barely clad, sitting under a tree with their eyes closed, perhaps, I'll get to that in a second, perhaps we can think about these kind of images. Right, and then reading the poetry around it that talks about the mendicants and giving up of yourself, right? and and about the truthfulness of the sanctuary, of the royal sanctuary, right? Something that it says here, that you have become a pearl diver in the sea of friendship, threading the pearl of loyalty on the standard of sincerity. If you respect the sanctuary of bounds of truthfulness, then you will be honored at her courts. And it says also that the sea will not disappear if you give away one drop out of generosity, and the sun will not vanish if you take away one small flash of light. Right? So the idea of giving up on things and then being loyal to the court, etc. And perhaps another interesting image that can be connected to this kind of pose, right, is the figure of a yogi, right, sitting in a yoga pose with very similar body traits, right? It's just that here we're looking at the European version of this kind of figure, perhaps. Right, so very different from, and I want to get back to this image, very different from the model of Adam that was based on the Torso Belvedere that was discovered at that time in Europe. Right, so based on a classical model, this has no meaning at all in India. That's not what they were trying to show in any way. So thinking about this in an Indian context brings us to a very different understanding of what this is. And then it is, in a second, then it is no longer Adam and it's no longer a copy, right? And it gets its own meaning and its own understanding of what such an image would be. And then I'm just going to show you another example from this idea, because it is such a beautiful drawing. And that's by Abul Hassan, who probably saw maybe a Dürer or maybe a copying of Dürer's engraving of the crucifixion, right? And here we're talking about 1600 in India and 1511 in Germany. And so again, extracting from a whole composition, right? So no longer the crucifixion. This is a single image on its own, right? St. John is a witness or participating in one of the difficult moments in Christianity, right? Christ's crucifixion. And with Mary, right, they form this kind of triangular shape of the three, the trio. This is not what's happening here. Right, we have this one single beautiful youth that has this ephemeral body with golden curls, right, with kind of clean-shaven face, with kind of dreamy eyes. I'll show you more details. Right, and the inscriptions here, and there are interesting inscriptions on this painting, are telling us another story, a completely different story. Right, so the first inscription here says Shah Salim, which means that the drawing was dedicated to Prince Salim, to Akbar's son, that will become Emperor Jahangir later on. But he was not an emperor yet. However, the artist is referring to him as Shah already, as king. Right, so that's an interesting relationship. With Dürer, we have a signature of the artist here and a date here. What we have in the Persian text is related to related to the fact that it was done by Abul Hassan. Right? It is telling us it was done by Abul Hassan, who was one of the artists working for Jahangir. And it says, Abul Hassan, son of Reza, a follower, meaning a follower of Jahangir. And then in another inscription telling us that it was done in his 13th year. So when he was about 12. So when he was 12 years old, Abul Hasan painted this. He was really a fabulous artist, and he was very, very talented. And it's a very unusual inscription, and the question is, what is it doing there? Why is it there, other than showing off, which is also a very unusual trait in those kind of paintings. And one of the things, and I also want to show you just the difference in the facial features. Right, one is miserable and one is not. Right, one is very handsome. You can't see it here, but when you look at the original, his lips are a little bit red. His teeth are kind of white, pearly white. He looks like this beautiful, handsome youth. Right, and the mouth is a little bit open. It's not so much open here. Right, he's looking up because he's looking up to Christ. He's not looking up because he is not looking up to Christ at all. So who is he and why is he? What does it mean to have such an image like that? And one of the interesting things about the image of Abul Hasan is that we have other images of these kind of blonde youths in paintings in a different, slightly different context of other mendicants, but also in a very homoerotic representation. So the question is, are we looking at the beautiful boy that was part of this kind of homoerotic practice of looking through the beauty of young boys at any kind of religious or spiritual practices? Are we looking at the saki, the cupbearer, who would bring those the wine into the older man? Is it some kind of a chorus boy from the Renaissance period? Unclear, but his context is definitely not that of the crucifixion, and he is made to look handsome. Right? And this is this kind of comparison is very interesting. The last thing I want to say about those kind of this kind of image and the inscriptions that we have here is that the competition with European artists was very clear. Right, establishing the Mughal artists were trying to establish their superiority and to bring innovation into that kind of material. And the fact that we have the inscription telling us that Abul Hasan was about 12 years old in his 13th year. It's probably related to the fact that Durer had a painting that on it he said it was a self-portrait, that on it he said that he was at the age of 13 when he painted that. You want to tell me that this is a coincidence? Absolutely not. So now we have to think what kind of conversations were happening between the artists and the other people who were bringing the image of Durer in their workshops. So there is a lot that we don't know and we probably will never know, but it is clear that this was a response to that, establishing Abul Hasan's superiority, right? Because he could paint those kind of images in a better way, right? In terms of Persian poetry and the classical Persian tradition, right? So inserting himself into this kind of tradition, but also exceeding. Right. So, and the last thing I want to talk about with respect to those kind of copying and interpretation is that they.